Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Wednesday, April 3rd. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, what bills are being taken off the table as lawmakers move beyond a major deadline in the state legislature. Then get outside and walk for a bit. That's the challenge being given by health experts today. It's National Walking Day. Plus, archaeologists are uncovering clues about the lives of enslaved people in Mississippi. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Dozens of bills have died on the calendar in both the Mississippi House and Senate. That includes measures for early voting, having the state take control over Jackson's water system, and changes to the Board of the State Employees Retirement System. Many general bills remain alive, but some of the most significant will need to be debated in a conference committee during conference between both chambers before they can be settled and handed over to the governor's desk. Republican Chris Johnson of Hattiesburg chairs the Senate Government Structure Committee. He chose not to bring up House Bill 1355. The measure would have changed the makeup of the PERS board.
We've all known that PERS is an issue that we need to tackle. The House sent a bill down to us. I think that it had the best of intentions on trying to find ways that we can ensure the soundness of PERS long term. I believe in the short term, PERS is just fine. But we want to make sure that we're making decisions now that keep it sound for future employees. And so I think in doing the hearing, we gained a lot of information. We've heard from lots of people. And just in the research that we've done, we think that it's very dangerous to make long-term decisions based on short-term data. And so when you deal with actuaries, it's all estimated numbers. And so the data can change significantly from year to year, which we've seen over the last 2 years. And we want to make sure that whatever we're doing does not put the state in a financial bind, but still make sure that PERS is sound and that all retirees and future retirees will get the benefits that they signed on for. There has been a significant amount of misinformation about PERS and that it's going to fail and it's not sound, and that is not true. PERS is sound. Retirees are going to continue to get their benefits, and that's a message that I think is very important because we want to make sure that no one is afraid that their livelihood is going to be taken away from them or their future livelihood that they've been working for. And everyone on the committee agreed on that. And I think in talking with members of the committee, we all agree that we care about retirees. We care about state employees. We want to make sure that they continue to have benefits and that they're always paid as they're supposed to be and that we make the system sound while at the same time not breaking the rest of the state.
One bill that did survive deadline day is for campaign finance reform. It would have set larger penalties on hopeful politicians who delay or forego filing their campaign revenues and expenses. But now that language is being scaled back by its author and being heavily modified. Republican Senator Jeremy England of Van Cleve chairs the Senate Elections Committee, and he is the original author of that measure, Senate Bill 2575. He tells our Will Stribling the core plan to overhaul enforcement of campaign finance laws is being taken out. England hopes conference meetings between the two chambers can still produce a quality bill.
Of course, we had a very large omnibus bill that we started out with earlier this year ran into some tough questions on the floor, which was expected. But what we did was what we often will do when we have questions to answer and we just need to move a bill along. We brought the code sections forward. I talked with Representative Zuber, and he was glad to bring that forward to get it to conference. And what I think he and I both expect out of conference is to work on online filing system, moving that forward. I think that's – look, campaign finance, transparency is always one of the most important things we can have. And I think having a good searchable online database for our constituents and for anyone that needs to look and see who is donating to campaigns or who is funding these initiatives or anything that's going on, we want a good searchable way to do that. Representative Zuber and I also think that it's a good idea to have municipal and county level officials also have online databases. Now, that's something that might not come forward this year, but it's something that we're committed to working on. But I do hope to get at least on our state level campaigns that we get that on an online filing system. I've talked to some of my members here. I think that any of the concerns that they had previously kind of got lost in the wash on just such a big bill, and I feel good about that. So I think we'll see that come forward. And we also may clarify that if a state corporation is limited to $1,000, that out-of-state corporations ought to be limited to $1,000 too, because we're not treating our in-state corporations the same we're treating outside corporations. I don't really know that anybody knew that until this election season when it became an issue. It's certainly a gray area. So I think if we can get those two things done this year, I would be happy with the status of campaign finance reform for the 2024 legislative session.
The elements of the original bill before it was amended in committee, the elements that pertain to enforcement of campaign finance violations, do you expect there to be any movement on that in conference, or is that, you know, an issue to be taken up another time?
Yeah, I don't expect it this year, but I do expect it to come up again maybe next year. And I think that, you know, we're just going to take smaller bites of this apple as we go along. I have talked with the Attorney General's office, talked with Lieutenant Governor, talked with Secretary of State. We all know that there are things that need to be done. And honestly, we needed to move some criminal code sections forward on that. And when we brought the code sections forward on the floor, an amendment, that didn't get into the bill, which is probably a good thing because, there's a lot that we can look at, and I think for 2025 legislative session, we'll certainly look back at the enforcement part of campaign finance reform.
Just more manageable bites of the issue.
That's right. And you know, when I presented the bill in the Senate, I mean, it took probably an hour and a half in there talking about it, answering questions. And, they're very good questions. One thing about Mississippi State Legislature as a whole, we've got a lot of smart people that do a good job vetting these bills and looking at them. So I appreciate their comments on that.
Early voting died. What are your thoughts on that? Because, I know this isn't the outcome that you wanted, but this is also the first time that any real conversation on this issue has taken place in this legislature on the Republican side of the aisle.
Yeah, and look, I'm disappointed that in-person early voting died this session. Of course, it was the first time we've brought it up, and as you know, anybody that follows the legislature knows that a lot of times it takes 2-3 years to get a piece of legislation through the system. And there's been a lot of issues we've had to take up with and that have kind of taken the oxygen out of the room. And I feel like that's probably the primary reason why we didn't see it come forward this year. I've talked with my counterpart, Representative Sanford in the House. He is not opposed to the bill. And we have talked about having hearings this summer to just allow folks to come in and talk about it, maybe get more comfortable with it. But it's certainly a thing that I'd like to see Mississippi do, is allow our hardest working folks out there, our single parents that, maybe a 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. on a Tuesday is keeping them from getting to the polls. And I want to we want to see our voter turnout increase, and I think that's a very good way to do it.
I know that at the beginning of the session you said that your goal was to demystify this issue and get folks to look beyond the fear mongering about insecurity and other election related issues that some people associate with early voting that are not connected. Did you see that in your chamber and among your colleagues?
Well, look, we passed it 44-8 in the Senate, and I was able to bring the bill forward and talk through those issues. And it's it's an issue nationally that I think Republicans have traditionally stayed away from, that being any form of early voting. I think now with the way the fast-paced world we live in, allowing the convenience of that, and polling also suggests that this is not a Republican or Democrat issue. Citizens of Mississippi would like the opportunity to show up at their circuit clerk office in person and cast an actual ballot. It just, and the integrity of having their votes not only register as counted in front of them, but also to be counted on election night. There's just so much to that. And I think that, look, I talked to our manufacturing folks. I talked to our hospitals. I talked to educators. I've talked to circuit clerks. A lot of people understand that this is a good idea. I think it's just, you know, anytime you make that big of a change in 1 year, I think it had people a little skittish on the idea. But, and look, I still expect some people to try to take this early voting issue and make it a rallying call and make it out to be like this is a liberal issue, but it quite frankly is not. And our citizens don't see it that way. And I think we've got a, you know, nationally we've got a bad problem with things getting lost in the muck of whether it's conservative or liberal. And I don't know who gets the authority to deem something to be conservative or liberal, but this is just good legislation. And so I think we'll see it again.
That's Republican Senator Jeremy England of Van Cleve. Next, get outside and walk for a bit. That's the challenge being given today by heart health experts. It's National Walking Day. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Want to keep up with MPB? Go to mpbonline.org, or you can find us on social media on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at MPB Online.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pohl Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Said. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
Thanks to our sustaining members who provide ongoing monthly financial support. You can become a sustainer too. Go to mpbonline.org and click Donate Now at the top of the page.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Today is National Walking Day, and the American Heart Association is challenging Mississippians to take the first steps towards a healthier life. Doctors say walking can help reduce stress, boost your mood, and help maintain a healthy body weight. But they also say walking across the nation is on the decline. Jennifer Hopping is executive director of the American Heart Association. She says National Walking Day is also a celebration of the organization reaching their 100th anniversary.
We know that walking is one of the simplest ways to get and stay active. And so also, of course, as we know, activity such as walking can help improve, you know, stress levels, your mood, but also helps lower the risk of diseases like heart disease. And so to participate in National Walking Day, anybody can do this. Individuals, grab a friend or a family member to get out and walk. If you work in an office, your office could wear their tennis shoes or bring their tennis shoes to work tomorrow and take a break and get walking. Or if you work from home, you know, just take a conference call on the go. You know, we talk about a lot, put in your ear pods while you're listening to a conference call and get out and walk. So anybody can be a part of the day tomorrow. The main thing is we want people to take a moment and realize the importance of physical activity and just walking in your day at some point.
How does walking prevent cardiovascular disease?
Well, we know physical activity, of course, gets your heart moving and, of course, is a leading risk factor lowering thing that we can do for our health, along with other things like eating healthy. But exercise is a big part of that. And so, you know, a lot of things that we have been talking about recently is how much that stress and mental well-being can affect your heart health. And so with the endorphins that are, you know, put off during physical activity, we know that that can also help to reduce stress levels and improve mental health and then improve mental well-being. So all of that's so important and going together to get people active and then to help prevent heart disease.
In many areas of the state, there's no sidewalks.
Yeah.
And that's a problem that creates a barrier for people being able to go out and walk.
It does. And so the American Heart Association for many years has been working on what we call safe streets. And that's exactly what we know is so important, because you need well-lit areas to walk and sidewalks. And so, unfortunately, we don't always have that here in the local area. You know, we do have good parks, you know, in the community. And so, you know, there's a lot of those parks that have walking paths. There's also the new walking path downtown that connects downtown. That's a great place to get out and walk that's safe and well lit. And unfortunately, like I said, we are working to try to improve those conditions. It does take time. We work with local cities to do that. But if you can't do it, you know, there's also ways you can, if you're a member of a gym, you know, you can do this inside and walk on a treadmill. But hopefully people can find a way that to pick a walking route of their choice that's safe.
Is there a pace at which walking is beneficial and a pace where you're not really getting much out of it because you're going so slow?
Well, I've had many doctors tell me something is better than nothing. So, you know, for those people that maybe don't traditionally exercise, doing anything is better than sitting sedentary. So it's going to be hard if you're not typically exercising every day or every, you know, three or four times a week to get out there and speed walk, you know, and that's okay. So we talk about, you know, just doing something is better. Now, if you exercise on the regular, of course, you're going to need to move faster with your steps. And so there's really no too little or too much. For everybody's different. So we just say know your own level of comfortable, you know, walking speed, and get out there and just do something. You know, that's the main thing, to get you started if you're not doing anything currently.
And with walking, what are the recommendations for what you should wear? And also, should you stretch before you walk and after?
Absolutely. Especially if you're going to be walking fast, you know, take a moment to warm up. We have our annual heart walk every fall. We always have somebody come and help the crowd warm up before they walk. And so stretching your legs, your feet, your ankles, don't want you to get injured. Of course, doing that and wearing comfortable shoes. You know, I think that's so important. Our feet are so important for us to stay healthy. And so making sure you have comfortable walking shoes on that have good support. And of course, it's getting warmer. So make sure you're not overdressed with too many clothes so you don't get too hot. And hydrate. You know, I think that's such an important part. Make sure you've got some water with you and you're stopping to drink along the way before you walk, and then as well as after you walk.
Is there a length of walking, a distance that has proven to be beneficial rather than maybe something very brief?
We talk about 10,000 steps a day, and so whatever that looks like. So a lot of people now, of course, wear smartwatches, or they've even got the rings now that will help monitor your steps each day. Those steps can be vigorous exercise, they can be moderate, and they can even be low impact, just like walking. And so just making sure that you're getting those steps in each day is really where we focus our education, because we know that if you're getting those steps every day, that you're getting enough activity to keep your heart healthy.
Jennifer Hopping is Executive Director of the American Heart Association. Coming up, an archaeology dig on a Mississippi plantation to learn how enslaved people lived. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hi, I'm Richard Gershon, the host of In Legal Terms and a professor at the University of Mississippi School of Law. If you miss a live In Legal Terms episode, find our podcast, inlegalterms.mpbonline.org.
Your old vehicle could be your next donation to support Mississippi Public Broadcasting at mpbonline.org.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Archaeologists in Mississippi are uncovering how enslaved people lived on an old plantation in the state before the Civil War. The plantation is called Prospect Hill and was once the home to more than 300 slaves. Those enslaved people were later freed in the 1840s and sent to Liberia. Sean Lambert is an associate professor of anthropology at Mississippi State University. He's speaking at History is Lunch today at noon at the two Mississippi museums in Jackson, and he'll share how slavery affects generations of people.
Prospect Hill is an early 19th to the late 19th century plantation site, just about 30 minutes outside of Natchez, Mississippi in Jefferson County. It is a plantation that once was comprised of thousands of acres, plantation land. Mostly it was cotton. At one point, Prospect Hill enslaved around 300 individuals before they were freed to Liberia in the 1840s.
So this must have been a very rich landowner.
Yes. He was a very rich landowner. When he passed away, his grandson took over, and soon after that, the wealth of that family started to increase substantially. But yes, I think they owned almost 4,000 acres, if not maybe a little bit more than that. So it was quite a large plantation.
What is it like now, today?
Well, right now, only a few acres are owned by the Archaeological Conservancy. The house, the plantation house, it is still standing. Now it is in disrepair. However, I will say the Archaeological Conservancy has worked really hard, get funds to put a new roof on it to make it at least waterproof. Now that house is the second house, which is the second house that was built in, I think, in the 1850s after the first house burned down in the 1840s.
I see. So this Prospect Hill plantation is in Jefferson County, and you've been involved in studying this. Are you doing archaeology digs?
Yes. It's kind of a multidisciplinary anthropological approach to this work. So first and foremost, I'm a community archaeologist, so I work heavily with descendant communities, especially working with areas and spaces of enslavement in Mississippi. So I think it's really important before you do archaeology at these sites to get the descendant community involved. So that's what we're trying to build, that network in here in Mississippi, working with the Archaeological Conservancy, as well as building that descendant community connection and networks in Liberia of those descendants whose families were sent to Liberia. And now those families who are still living today are understanding their connection to Mississippi. And so what they want us to do is starting to kind of understand the history of Prospect Hill through excavating these areas where enslaved people lived and worked at Prospect Hill. And it's really important to do this type of archaeology because this part of history, especially Mississippi, is not always talked about. And sometimes it's been difficult to talk about. So doing the excavations, discovering the artifacts are really important because artifacts are powerful storytellers, and they allow us to tell the stories of the people. And especially we can connect those material culture or those artifacts to the descendants who are still living today. It's a pretty powerful narrative. And so not only are we doing archaeology, but we have cultural anthropologists working on this who are doing oral interviews. So kind of doing oral historical and oral memory research. So working with the descendant communities to understand their cultural heritage of this site and their connections to the site.
How far do you dig when you do this type of work? And what type of artifacts are you finding?
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, so this site, it all depends on where you are around the world and what type of archaeological site you're working on. But this site's pretty easy to excavate. The material culture and the features, such as if you're trying to find a house foundation, it's pretty shallow. So I wouldn't dig more than, usually you don't have to dig more than 20 or 30 centimeters or about, 10 or 12 inches before you get to the bottom of what you're finding, of the material culture. So it's pretty shallow. Now, the artifacts that we're finding are, we've been working in the area of the kitchen house where enslaved people lived and worked right next to the larger house. And we are finding every day kitchen and items, things that they would cook with, but also we're finding the food that they were eating and the food they were depositing. We're also finding things they wore. So we're finding buttons and parts of their clothes. We're finding some really interesting things where they are transforming some material culture, such as we're finding that they took the glass. They're taking European-made wine bottles, for instance, and they're taking the bases of those, and they're napping them into really finely made blades, and they're using that to work to polish or cut wood, or maybe making traditional hickory baskets and things like that. So we're seeing that the enslaved people who lived at Project Hill were kind of transforming the materials they were getting to do some really interesting things.
What are you going to do with them?
Our next stage is we're going to be submitting a National Geographic grant in the next month to do archaeology in Liberia. So we're going to actually do archaeology at those first settlements that Isaac Ross, when Isaac Ross freed the enslaved individuals, almost 300, mind you, to Liberia, we're going to do excavations at those first settlements when they settled in Liberia. And so once we get that done, and we're going to be doing a lot of oral historical and oral memory research there, so we're going to be interviewing the descendant communities there as well. We're going to create an interactive website so people can track what we're doing, so they can see that type of research. But we would love to work with the two museums here in Jackson, Mississippi, to create an exhibit of these findings with the voices of the descendant communities, so people can listen to the people today who have those important historical and cultural connections to the site. So not only we will get an understanding of the material culture, but how it resonates today in the present.
All right, Sean Lambert, Assistant Professor of Archaeology at Mississippi State University. You will be speaking at noon today for History is Lunch, the two Mississippi museums. Thank you so much for your time and speaking with us.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.